Yeah, so we're on page 144 in the Feldheim Chumash, and we're starting the Seder Truma. As I was saying, this starts a whole series of Sedras, which go right through pretty well to the middle, to the end of the book of Leviticus, Vayikra. Much of it dealing with the building of the tabernacle in the desert, and the divine service that took place in the temple. Because temple worship plays a major part in Jewish life. The amazing thing is, the majority of the commandments, the majority, remember, there are 248 positive commandments and 365 negative commandments. That's a total of 613. The majority of those have to do with the service in the temple. What we're left with now that the temples have been destroyed and we've been in exile for around 1900 years, we only have about 84, I think it is, or approximately, that number of positive commandments out of 248, which is about a third. The rest of them are to do with the temple and to do with agricultural laws in the land of Israel. But I'm pretty sure when I say that the majority is to do with the temple. So we can see how fundamental temple life is in Jewish teachings. And we have a major hole in our observance of the Torah's standard for how a Jew should live. There's a major gap because we don't have a temple. Now, all is not lost, because the rabbis assure us that everything that was achieved through the temple service is able to be achieved whilst we're in exile as well, in using different modes, different behaviors. I'll give you an example. Prayer. The rabbis base themselves on a pasuk. I think it's in Isaiah. We actually quote it in our morning prayers, in the introductory part of our morning prayers, which deals with the sacrifices, where we read over the various daily sacrifices that were brought in the temple. And towards the end of that section, he quotes and says, "Unashalma Purim Sifaseinu." We will pay oxen with our lips. What does that mean? We will pay oxen with our lips. The oxen refers to the sacrifices. So now that we don't have a temple, how are we paying those oxen? How are we enacting the temple sacrifices? With our lips. By our prayers, we are achieving the same thing as they did in the temple. And the Rebbe pointed out a very interesting thing, that in a certain sense we have an advantage over temple times as well. Because in temple times, those sacrifices could only be brought during the day. Daytime is the time for sacrifices. At night, there were some minor things done in the temple. They were allowed to complete the burning of the various parts of the sacrifices that had to be burned. But no sacrifices were processed at night. Only during the day. Whereas now, if we pray at night, then we've achieved as if we brought a sacrifice at night. So there's an advantage over what happened in those times. Another example. The temple is the site of where the sacrifices are brought. Once the temple is built, one is not allowed to bring a sacrifice anywhere else. So it's called the Bamas Yochid. It means a private altar. No one is allowed to build a private altar when the temple is standing. So the location of where the sacrifices were brought was only in the temple. But now, when we pray, we could be absolutely anywhere. Anywhere in the world. A Jew we've been exiled to most of the countries of the world, and what with Lubavitch and their Chabad houses, we're in even more countries than we were exiled to. Where the basic idea is to try and chase down wherever Jews have got to in the world, even though they weren't exiled there. You know, the original exile was North Africa, Southern Europe, Babylon. You know, the farthest reaches were Assyria. You know, like within 1,000 miles of Israel. But Jews, with their Wanderlust, have managed to get themselves to Vietnam and to Thailand and all these exotic places. And they weren't exiled over there. They've gone for business. Or you know, China and Shanghai and Beijing.
Jews. Are there still Jews in Shanghai?
The main enclaves of Jews in all these places today are business people. Israelis, Americans, and similar, who Jewish, who are out to make a buck.
I see.
Or a yen.
Yes.
They have a yen to make a buck.
Yes.
So they're the ones. So the Chabad houses in all these places, it's either Israeli backpackers.
Yeah.
They'll be in places like Thailand and Tibet.
And Mumbai, unfortunately.
Right. And then in these other places where there's a lot of business, such as Japan, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing, they're all there for business. So it's mainly Israelis and Americans and a few other nationalities. But we weren't exiled over there.
No.
It's a kind of voluntary exile. And many of them stay there for years. So the Chabad houses are busy with those kind of people, as well as Israeli backpackers. But that's a by the way. But what I'm saying is that wherever a Jew is, he could be in Beijing, he could be in Shanghai, he could be in Hong Kong or Thailand or wherever it is, he makes a prayer. He has brought a sacrifice. Not physically, but in essence, he's achieving the same thing as a sacrifice. So in a certain sense, ironically, we have even more power to serve God when we're in exile than when we have the temple. So then of course everyone will ask, well, hang on, that means we don't need the temple. Let's continue like this. We're in on an even higher level. The answer to that is, obviously, it's a kind of comfort to us that we can, that no door is closed to us. But the ideal situation is that we should be serving God according to his original intentions, where there is tremendous spiritual power generated by the bringing of sacrifices. So, in other words, if we do have a temple, things are good because we can bring the sacrifices. If we don't have the temple, we have a replacement which is suitable as a temporary replacement. But it's not a permanent solution. It's a bit like somebody, you know, broke a leg, so they set it in plaster. So they can walk, but it's not an ideal situation. You know, the best thing is to have a whole leg and be able to walk normally. If the leg broke, it's okay, so the doctors can plaster it back up again, and temporarily they're walking around with the plaster. So they're still walking, but it's achieving, but you can't compare it to the original situation of the most ideal state. So hence, the building of this Mishkan, this tabernacle, is a crucial element of Judaism. And this is evidenced by the fact of how God explains or expresses the request to build this temple. What is the word he uses for this temple? Well, there are two words. One is mikdosh, which means a sanctuary, from the word kodesh, like the word kaddish, connected with the word kaddish, which means holy, a holy prayer. So kodesh or mikdosh is the holy place, the temple. But the word that God uses is another word, mishkan. And that comes from the word shekhinah, which means an indwelling. The word shachain in Hebrew means a neighbor. Lishkon in Hebrew means to dwell. So the Mishkan is the place where God dwells.
And Shekhinah is?
Shekhinah is the indwelling, the presence, divine presence,
so
the
what's
indwelling.
What's the connection between the divine presence and the neighbor?
Both dwell. The indwelling, the word to dwell.
All my neighbours, divine presence.
They're not, maybe not be divine, they're just presence. They're there. They're dwelling. So the expression that God uses, Va'asu li mikdash, make for me a sanctuary, v'shachanti v'socham, and I will dwell amongst them. That's interesting. Because he doesn't say, make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell in it. He says, I will dwell in them. And the rabbis pick that up and say, V'shochanti b'socho lo nema. It does not say, I will dwell in it. It says, I will dwell in them. God is inside us. And that actually links up with what we started off with. Because we said only a few minutes ago that when we don't have a temple, we can still serve God. And almost at the same level. Because our prayers are instead of bringing sacrifices. And when God says, I will dwell in them, he's saying, I'm with the Jewish people irrespective of whether they have a temple or not. And the rabbis actually put this into words and they say an amazing thing. Galu le'edaim shechina imahem. When the Jewish people were exiled to Edom, which normally is associated with Rome, the Roman exile, the Roman Empire, the destruction of the Second Temple. When they were exiled to Rome, the Divine Presence went with them. When they're exiled to Babylon, Galu le'bavel, shechina imahem. When they're exiled to Babylon, the Divine Presence is with them. So this is actually supporting what we were saying before. That when we're in exile, we've got a very close relationship with God because he comes with us. And actually the rabbis learn this out from the fact that it says, V'shav Hashem lekercha eshevuscha, that God will return with your captivity. So the rabbis say, V'heshiv lo ne'ema ela v'shav. It doesn't say God will bring back our captivity. Like, he's over there in Israel, and we're over here in England, and he's going to reach out and bring us back. So he's been in Israel the whole time. No. It says, V'shav Hashem lekecha eshevuscha. God will return with your captivity. Meaning he's with us in captivity. It's not that he's stretching out from Israel with the long arm of the, you know, the long Israeli arm, right, and bringing us back. He's actually with us. And he's coming back to the land of Israel with Mashiach, with us. Which brings out a profound idea that God is with the Jewish people even more than he is with the temple. Which brings a kind of paradox in its wake, because then we're back to the old question, what do we need the temple for? So it's a kind of balancing act. The exile situation is not the ideal situation. Given that it's not an ideal situation, God says, I'm with you in exile. But it's not ideal. That's not the situation that we're really hankering
after. The temple, when it's built, will be in Jerusalem?
Yes. On the site that it is
Jerusalem, that will be the central point, though.
It will.
Won't it?
Yeah.
So you could say, well, God is everywhere, but that is his head office.
Absolutely. Well put. Very well put. The way you put it actually is brought in Tanya. And it explains that the body is an example of how this works. Because what we know that we're animated by a soul. The soul is keeping us all alive. Now, the soul fills our whole body. So it's everywhere. It's like when we say God is everywhere in the world. The soul is everywhere in our body. Our little finger is just as alive as our ears, nose, heart, feet, or any other major organ, or brain. You can't say that the finger is less alive than any other part of the body. And yet, it's a minor part of the body. So life, the life force, is everywhere. But where is the main place where we see the soul manifesting itself? That's pretty obvious, that it's in the brain. The brain is called the Mishkan, of the nefesh, the site where the main manifestation of the soul is. As we know, the brain is controlling every single part of the body. So that moshel, that parable, is used in Tanya to explain God's relationship with the world. Well, exactly what you just said. Head office. The God is everywhere. But head office is Yerushalayim in the temple. In the temple itself there are levels until you get into the holies, and then the Holy of Holies, and in the Holy of Holies you've got the Aron, the Ark of the Covenant with the two cherubs, and God's presence is most manifest at that point between the faces of the two cherubs, who by the way are the faces of a boy and a girl.
Has anybody other than the high priest ever seen the two cherubs?
No. Except the Romans and the Babylonians when they broke into the
priests, if they ever went in there,
they were only allowed to go in on Yom Kippur.
So they must have seen the cherub.
Yeah, the only other exception to that is workmen who had to mend the Holy of Holies, and they went in from the roof. There was a trapdoor in the roof, and they were let down on like you have window cleaners on a kind of platform coming down from the roof. So the same thing there, they had to paint it every so often, and they had their backs to it, but probably they were able to see it. Those are the exceptions, but only the high priest on Yom Kippur was allowed in the Holy of Holies. Okay, so now with this introduction we can now start to understand the crucial nature of the temple and why so much is written about it in the Chumash, and so many laws are associated with it. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe Lema. God spoke to Moses, saying, page 144. Daber el Bnei Yisrael v'yikhu li truma. Speak to the children of Israel, and they should take for me a gift, a raising up of a gift, meaning a donation. Me'eis kol ish ashei yidvena libo. From every person. It doesn't necessarily mean men. It can mean women as well, because we know the women also gave. Everybody gave. Tikhu es trumasi. You shall take my tithe or contribution. So yidvenu liba means from the word nadav. Nadav means to donate voluntarily.
It's a name, isn't it?
It's a name as well, because it's got good connotations. Nadav means generous. Someone who's generous. And nadvan in Hebrew means a generous person, because he's menadev. He volunteers. He gives generously. Sorry?
Mitnadev
is a volunteer, yeah. So, this donation was optional. The one that wanted to give more, gave more. And the one who wanted to give less, gave less. So this was a very important element of the building of the Mishkan, in that it was optional. That means it left room for people to express themselves. And if they wanted to be really involved, they got really involved. And if they didn't want to get so involved, they didn't get so involved. And if they didn't want to give anything, they didn't give anything. What we do find, however, is in practice, they were so generous that they ended up giving too much. And an announcement had to be sent through the camp to say that no more gifts should be brought to the tabernacle, because we have more than enough. So that is the first kind of donation, a voluntary donation. And to a large extent, Jewish life reflects this, because when we have communal Jewish life, you find, as in most societies, you have the givers, the generous givers, and then the not so generous givers, and then the even less generous givers, and then you have a few takers as well. In any community, you have this situation. And it expresses how Jewish life is run. So now we read about the kind of donations that they gave. This is the donation which you shall take from them. Zahav v'chesev v'necharshes. Based, obviously, starting with the most valuable things, gold, silver, and copper. All of these things were used in the building of the Mishkan. Uscheles and blue wool. Vargamon and purple wool. V'solash shani and scarlet yarn, which is also a kind of wool. The sheish and linen, the izim and hair of goats. So it's interesting, they had the hair of sheep in various different colors. They had the hair of goats, which was generally white. And they also had something that was of vegetable origin, and that was shesh, which means linen. So they were au fait with producing cloth from grass, because flax is a kind of grass. So, and they all were ingredients in the making of the various curtains that were used in order to make a tent-like structure. The basic structure is like this box, right? We've got this box of dates over here. This is a perfect, divine providence has provided us with a sample Mishkan over here, exactly, almost exactly the right proportions. Don't know who donated these dates, but they do look very nice. Well, I must tell you that by the kosher laws, just by the way, when you eat dates, one should really check that they're not infested, because there can be worms and eggs and little caterpillars in soft fruits.
I don't ever eat dates myself. But
they're very, very healthy. Very, very healthy. Yeah. But just by the way,
even Australian.
So what one should do is open them first.
Oh, I see.
Any dates from anywhere, whether they're sugared or not, because when they sugar them, they don't check whether they're infested or not. So what you have to do is, like, either with a knife or with your hand fingers, open the date and check around.
Would you see?
Well, you would. Yeah, you see either the remains of the creature.
Happened once when it was a fig.
Yes, it can happen.
Maggots.
Yeah, so one should be good, because eating one of these creepy crawlies is actually even worse than eating pork. Okay, if you can believe that. So it's not very pleasant either. Just to, by the way, as the dates are sitting here, I thought I would mention it. But anyway, the Mishkan was in the form of this box, and the walls were vertical beams, tremendously heavy vertical beams. This is 10 cubits high from there to there. And these vertical beams were slotted into sockets that were at the bottom underneath. So there was like a mortise and tenon joint. The sockets were like that, and the beams had holes at the bottom. So it's called a mortise and tenon joint. Did you ever study woodwork? No? Mortise and tenon?
I've heard about it. I don't do it. But
the mortise is the hole, and the tenon is the
I've
finger.
I've heard about that.
And it's called them. They were held like this.
Yeah.
So, and very firm. They were exactly fitted in a rectangular shape. It's called, that's what the carpenters call it, mortise and tenon.
But to get back to the date, if you open and see the insect in there, you don't eat the dates.
Well, if it's a small fruit like a date, it's not worth cutting around, because you might miss it. Best throw the date. But if it was a peach, you don't have to throw the whole peach away. If there's a worm in a peach, you just cut out the infested part, and you can eat the rest of the peach.
Right. Otherwise,
but these small fruits like dates, it's not worth messing around. Even figs, you could probably cut it out, as long as you know you've cut out the infestation. So, getting back to the point, so where did the cloths come in? Where did the curtains come in? They were laid over, actually like this, along like my fingers. They were long strips. I mean, we're talking about a very big structure here. 10 cubits is about 15 feet high. You know, like 1.5 times the height of this room. So, that was the height of it. And then the cloths, the curtains, were made into strips. 4 cubits wide, which would be about 6 foot wide curtains, strips. Each of them sewn to the other and linked with hooks in the middle. And they went from the bottom here along the top and down the other side.
It must have been skilled people to do this.
Yeah, of course. It was a major, major task. So these strips were... So it made a cloth roof to this box. At the front, there was an opening, right, where there was a kind of curtain, a vertical curtain, to so you can't just look in, to make it modest. And then at the back end, of course, it was closed. So it was like a box like this, covered with curtains and open at the front. And inside here, there was the back end was a square room, 10 cubits by 10 cubits, where it was the Holy of Holies. And the front part, near the door, was 20 cubits by 10 cubits, and that was called the Ulam, or the Holies, which was of lesser holiness compared to the Holy of Holies. In the Holy of Holies you had the Ark of the Covenant, and in the Holies, the lesser part, you had three vessels. One was a table with showbreads on it. One was a menorah with seven branches. And then there was a small golden altar, more towards the curtain at the front. And that was where they burned the daily incense.
It sounds like the Bema.
Yes, it has similarities to Shul. Absolutely. The Shul of today is modeled in shape on the temple. The front end is where the Ark of the Covenant, and we call it the Ark. That's where the Torah is. Because what was inside the Ark of the Covenant? What was inside the box? It was a gold box inside, a wooden box inside a golden box.
The
Ten Commandments, absolutely. And there was also a Sefer Torah there as well.
The Holy of Holies.
Yeah. So that's in Shul. We have at the front of the Shul, we have the Ark. And inside there, we have the Torah. So that models that. And then you have a curtain in front of the Holy of Holies. So that's the curtain in front of the Ark.
Yeah.
We draw the curtain to open up. And then from in front of the curtain, like you, as you rightly pointed out, Michelle, you have the Bima. So the Bima represents the... Well, actually, the Bima, in a sense, represents a kind of altar, but there was a bigger altar outside in the courtyard where the sacrifices were burned. This smaller altar inside was only for burning incense, which is a kind of powder. And then you've got the menorah. Well, in Shul, also, you have the Ner Tomid. There's a custom of having an everlasting light in a shul to remind us of the menorah. And then, well, we don't really have a table, but in general, there it's commemorative of the shape of the Mishkan and the temple.
So you're not allowed to sit on a table?
Yes, yes, there is a connection with that too. The Jewish table at home is regarded as a holy thing, and the rabbis compare it to an altar. And why do they compare it to an altar? Because they say, just like the altar in the temple was used to serve God by taking some physical creature and sacrificing it to God, our table at home is also to be used for helping other people by inviting guests and help and letting them share our food. So we're also using... If it's meat, it's meat. If you don't want to eat meat, you don't need to eat meat. But the principle is there that we're using our table to elevate the physical world, the world of the animal, the vegetable, whatever it is, and use it to serve God. That means sharing our prosperity with others by inviting guests to our home. The rabbis say explicitly that our table is compared to an altar, and we should treat it as such and not treat it in an offhand way, and that's one of the reasons why we don't sit on a table. So these are the raw materials, the Oros Elim Mardomim, and the skins of rams dyed red. Must have been very exotic and beautiful. There's a book actually in the library here which shows the pictures, and pretty well every time I forget to bring it along, but maybe next week I'll remember. The Oros Techoshim Va'atzei Shittim, and the skins of a creature which is called a tachash, which Rashi tells us was multicolored and also only existed for a short time, and the and atzei shittim, which means cedar wood.
I wonder now, if that's where the word tuchus is. That Yiddish, or does it come from
the word
tuchus?
No connection. No. This is the word shittim, which is means cedar wood. Interesting that the word shittim is used, because actually the word for cedar in Hebrew is erez. Erez, it's also a modern Israeli name, cedar. But the word that's chosen here in the Chumash is shittim. Now, there's a vast literature of Hasidic teachings which talk about the significance of the use of this word shittim. Why does the Torah describe the wood as atzei shittim, shittim wood. And one of the answers that's given is that the word shita in Hebrew means to turn aside. And it's actually connected with the word shtus, which means foolishness.
Shtuyot,
very good. We can all rely on Marion to give us the Ivrit, a modern Hebrew connection with a word that we use. Very good.
Stupid.
Correct. Well, fool and stupid, similar word, yes. So, where does foolishness come into the whole concept of building a Mishkan, a tabernacle to God? Because these Atzei Shittim are the vertical beams that I mentioned that form this box. There are actually, how many beams are this? Was 30 long, one and a half. There's 20 along this side, 20 along that side, 8 along that side, and 2 over there. So there were actually 50 beams altogether. And, I tell a lie. At this end there were only 6. This end there were only 6. Yeah. So these beams, why they call that Shittim? So Hasidic teachings explain like this. Foolishness generally is a negative thing. If we talk about someone's a fool, are we complimenting them?
No.
No. So it's a negative thing. Foolishness, stupidity, ashaita in Hebrew is the noun. It means a fool, an idiot. There are enough epithets in the English language that cover this, because I suppose there's a lot of foolish people around, so we need a lot of words. So, in what way can we find something positive about foolishness? When can you have positive foolishness? That should be that in the Mishkan, the Torah is telling us, you use wood which is associated with foolishness. So Hasidic teachings explain like this. You have two kinds of foolishness. There's a shtus del umazeh, which means a foolishness which is negative, which is what most people think of when you use the word fool or foolishness. But there's also a shtus de kedusha, a foolishness of holiness as well. Let me paint you a picture. A picture of a chassid in Russia. A Lubavitcher chassid in Russia, who was born under the communist regime. And by a miracle, his parents managed to bring him up as a chassid, even though the forces of communism were so strong that most people could not maintain their religious observance in the face of the unbelievable pressures that the communists managed to level against the Jewish community. But this chassid says, no, I am not going to compromise, no matter what. So somebody says to him, what do you mean no matter what? You know what can happen to you? At the worst, they'll shoot you. A bit better than that, 20 years in Siberia. A bit better than that, 10 years in Siberia. A bit better than that, 3 years hard labor. And you're saying no matter what, you're willing to risk being shot, you're willing to risk going to Siberia for 20 years, because you want to hang on to your precious Judaism? And the chassid turns around and says, yes. And what's the proof? It actually happened. There were hundreds, but hundreds, of Hasidim in Russia. I admit that a number did not manage to hold firm, and no one can judge them, because torture, prison, labor, Siberia, all of these are only the hardiest of people can resist such pressures and tortures. So many, or I won't say many, some did not manage, and they compromised. But many did not, and they were sent to Siberia, or they were shot, or they were given 3 years hard labor. Now, what is the attitude of a person that says that and says, I am not going to compromise? other people, rational people, would say, you're a fool. You're killing yourself. Even though Judaism itself doesn't actually demand that we give our lives under such circumstances. Judaism actually allows for us to compromise if it's to save our life. If somebody says to a Jew, eat that pork or else you'll get shot. Is he allowed to eat the pork? Do we know?
Well, you know, it said that our life is more important than anything.
Correct.
What did you say now?
So someone is threatened that he has to eat some tray for food or else he'll be shot. Is he allowed to eat the tray for food? Yeah.
I should think so. Well,
there are only three things. There are only three things we have to give our life for.
In the war.
Yeah. There are only three things we have to give our life for. They're not to murder someone else. One has to be allow oneself to be killed before one kills someone else. Not to worship idols. If someone says, bow down to that idol, or else it's your last day, then you're not allowed to bow down to the idol. Or the third thing is not to commit an immoral act, adultery or similar. One's not allowed to do that either to save one's life. Apart from that, if someone says, eat this chaza, or else he'll get shot, he's allowed to eat the chaza. So this chassid, who says, I'm going to allow myself to go to Siberia, or even be shot, and going to Siberia was almost always a death sentence. And he says, no, I'm not going to shave my beard. I'm not going to compromise on anything. I'm going to continue with my kosher food. I'm going to shul. They might have gone into hiding. They didn't actually blatantly, you know, like push themselves in the limelight. But they said, I'm willing to risk being arrested. And the proof? They were arrested. You all know Mrs. Liberov, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, her father was taken and shot.
I heard about it.
And why? Because he was a moil.
Oh, was it?
He was a moil. And he said, if someone comes to me and says they've got a child, a boy that needs a bris, I'm going to do it no matter what. And his wife said, look, you're going to get arrested, you're going to get shot. He says, I cannot refuse a bris. Now, Jewish Judaism does not say that you're obliged to do a circumcision and risk your life. You're allowed to desist. You're allowed to ignore it.
So he did that and he was shot.
And he did it. He was actually trapped. He was tricked. Because the communists knew he was doing this. So they sent a plant. They sent someone to trick him, to ask him to come and do a bris. And really, there wasn't a bris. But he went. So that was the proof that he's a criminal.
Mrs. Liberov's father.
And he was shot. Mrs. Liberov's father, yeah. His name is Olchana.
Shot to death?
Shot to death. Never came back.
Never.
I'm sure she would have told you this story. So this is shtus. This is atzei shittim. This is where you have an example of foolishness, but it's holy foolishness. And that's what the basis of our holy temple is. A Jew has to know that our attachment to God is super rational. That we'll do things for God that sometimes don't make sense. We'll leave it there, ladies.
Who's taking the lecture?
Dr. Lowenthal, of course.